Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
J.G. Watt's Flood Relief Fund tops $8.5 million after boost from Walmart and Ellen DeGeneres. By Kevin Liu. Donations continue to soar for the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund set up by J.G. Watt, defensive end for the Houston Texans, as the NFL player once again increases his fundraising target, this time to $10 million. Watson's relief effort for the Houston floods has now brought in more than $8.5 million, following a $1 million donation from supermarket chain Walmart, presented by talk show host Ellen DeGeneres. When Texas needed him, J.G. Watt was there. I was honored to help make this amazing gift from Walmart possible, DeGeneres said on Twitter after presenting the donation on her television show. This was truly unbelievable, Watt tweeted in reply. Thank you, Ellen. Heavy rains flooded the Houston area as Harvey slammed into Texas as a Category 4 hurricane late Friday. At least 31 people have died due to the storm, the Associated Press reports. The toll is expected to rise as the extent of the devastation becomes clearer. Tens of thousands are believed to have been displaced from their homes, and many are in urgent need of water and other vital items. Apart from the $1 million Walmart donation, Watt's fundraising campaign, which began with a modest $200,000 target, has seen more than 83,000 donors chip in a total of more than $7.7 million as of 10 p.m. local time Wednesday.
The 8 Best New Fall TV Shows You Should Watch by Daniel Daddario. It's impossible to know from a pilot episode which new fall TV shows will wear well over time. There are plenty of great shows with subpar first outings or shows whose first episodes dazzled before a fizzle or a cancellation later on. But the raw materials of a good show, the cast, the sensibility, ought to be in place early on. These are the 8 upcoming fall TV shows that seem the most sturdily built, the ones that encourage us to watch more as the season goes on. It's worth noting that a couple of pilots, including NBC's Law & Order True Crime, the Menendez murders, were not available to screen by press time. Like so much about the fall TV schedule, we'll have to wait and see. Here are the best new fall TV shows premiering in 2017. The Orville premieres September 10th on Fox. This overstuffed and perhaps overambitious hour was created by and stars Family Guy mastermind Seth MacFarlane, and yet plays it entirely straight. Indeed, the series, an overt homage to the original Star Trek, has far fewer out-and-out jokes than one might expect, instead relying on a general tone of zany adventurousness to earn your attention. Though far from perfect in its early going, the show's fun, sunny energy could win over fans of classic sci-fi and those who vibe with MacFarlane's geekier, less nihilistic impulses. Me, Myself, and I premieres September 25th on CBS. Even more than most series, a show with a clever premise is hard to judge early on, as its fortunes will rise or fall based on how well the premise wears over time. And yet, in the early going, CBS's new Bobby Moynihan sitcom is eminently likable and warm-hearted. Moynihan plays a man living in the present day. We toggle back to see him as a child, Jack Dylan Grazier, and forward into the future to see him as a successful golden ager, John LaRoquette. Lessons, fairly simple ones, but this is only a pilot, from his youth resonate through the years as he only begins to figure them out in midlife and enjoys the benefits of an old man. Do any of the three look like one another? Not really. But the conceit's carried out with good humor that will hopefully last for seasons to come. The Good Doctor premieres September 25th on ABC. Freddie Highmore of Bates Motel plays another character who sees the world differently on this adaptation of a South Korean drama series. His precocious Sean Murphy is a pediatric surgeon on the autism spectrum whose house-like ability to see what other doctors can't runs up against his, well, house-like lack of a bedside manner. Not much is new in this pilot, but Highmore sells the part, and an elegantly made, confident medical procedural is always welcome. 10 Days in the Valley premieres October 1st on ABC. Kira Sedgwick, The Closer, returns to TV with this taut, painfully intense kidnapping thriller. As Jane Sadler, a producer for a generic crime drama, Sedgwick is both a ringleader of mayhem and a victim. While she's in her writer's shed at home, one night trying to finish a scene, her young daughter disappears from her bed. Jane's chaotic professional life and her somehow even messier than it seems relationship with her estranged husband could play a role in her daughter's disappearance. Either way, they provide ample material for the star of a psychological study to play. Sedgwick here begins to come apart and does so virtuosically. Ghosted premieres October 1st on Fox. Adam Scott and Craig Robinson, players on respectively Parks and Recreation and The Office, were always strong even when their shows faltered a bit. So it's no surprise that together their chemistry elevates a pilot for a series whose plot is a bit too convoluted to be satisfyingly explained in 30 minutes. Scott plays a conspiracy theorist obsessed with the paranormal, while Robinson plays an ace investigator who'd been taken off the job. Together, they've been recruited to be a sort of overtly comic X-Files team, digging into supernatural happenings around L.A. The plot in the show's first half hour is less compelling than the pair's star power. They make for a team worth following. Let's see if the show's story picks up steam. The Gifted premieres October 2nd on Fox. The Gifted, which tells the story of young mutants exploring their powers, promises to be one of the best Marvel Universe TV series because it plays things relatively straight. The series lacks the elaborate fripperies that made FX's Legion such a challenging watch, and also eschews the endless throat-clearing that characterizes some of the Marvel series on Netflix. This is a brisk-to-the-point story that quickly establishes compelling stakes. Stephen Moyer and Amy Acker play the parents of two children, Natalie Aylin Lind and Percy Hines White, with mutant abilities, forced to try to evade a government that would prefer to wipe out those who deviate from the norm. Who knows how it'll wear over a season, but the first hour was delightfully decisive in a way few other comic book shows allow themselves to be. This is a show that knows what it wants to do and trusts you to go along. The Mayor premieres October 3rd on ABC. Courtney Rose, Brandon Michael Hall, is an aspiring rapper who decides in a bid for attention to run for municipal office. It should come as no surprise, given the state of American politics, that he ends up winning. Indeed, Courtney's sanguine about winning the post. How much work does a mayor have to do, anyhow, but shocked that the job lasts a whole 4 years? The time will go by a little easier with help from a political hack played by Lea Michele, refreshingly finding a new tone from her aggressively peppy Glee character, and the support of his mom, Yvette Nicole Brown. In its first 30 minutes, the mayor establishes an appealing set of characters in a real-feeling yet slightly askew town and finds a chilled-out, amiable tone that could eventually place it in the top tier of ABC's strong family comedies. Dynasty premieres October 11th on the CW. A sharp-edged update of the classic melodrama from soap savant Josh Schwartz, the OC Gossip Girl. Dynasty exists precisely on the wavelength of its potential viewers. The Dynasty here is a family-run energy company whose patriarch, Blake Carrington, Grant Cho, is on the precipice of an ill-advised marriage to an interloper, Arriviste Crystal, Nathan Lee Kelly, to his equally avaricious kid's horror. Just about the only flaw, for viewers who've been hungering for cruel, witty thrills, is the insistence of trying to connect the story to contemporary themes, as with references to other dynasties in the news, the Trumps, the Kardashians. Who needs such laborious grasps of relevance when the fun of hair-pulling is eternal?
A thrilling Game of Thrones finale sets up a bold new story. By Daniel Daddario. Warning, this post contains spoilers for Season 7 of Game of Thrones. A startlingly effective Game of Thrones season finale Sunday night bid farewell, among other entities, to the long-standing wall that stood between humanity and chaos. The collapse of the wall, which occurred at the very end of the episode, augured an end to the scrupulous order which had seemed to last far too long. Much of the season had felt rigorously choreographed to forestall action or to preserve key actors from entering the fray. This episode removed those barriers and brought forward the sort of thrilling future a show can present when it's no longer wasting its time. Little things first. As it were, the death of Littlefinger brought to an end a somewhat frustrating parlor game among fans of guessing who was wearing whose face. Was Arya impersonating Sansa? Was the Waif impersonating Arya? It seemed, reading fan reactions, as though this was the sort of show that allows a mystery to draw out for more than a shot or two. Game of Thrones has always been straightforward in its storytelling, and indeed its representation of Arya and Sansa's coming together with the help of Bran to end the life of Littlefinger seemed to elide the two sisters' long-time enmity dating back to their childhoods. It also seemed to elide the fact that, his dislike of Littlefinger notwithstanding, Bran has mostly provided fairly random outputs to conversational stimuli. The scene, nevertheless, brought a gratifying end to a season in which the two Stark sisters were perpetually compelling, but at times adrift in their story. And while it killed off a character who realistically had no further purpose to serve, its greatest purpose may have been setting up a whole new dynamic for two sisters who never got along. Further unity of previous enemies, the coupling of John and Danny. Occurring against the fairly untelegenic backdrop of Bran reciting the ways in which they are related, I know there was no better way to depict this, but at the same time, there has to have been. The brief shot brings together as a romantic couple two figures who, as leads in the show's main action, were mainly sidelined this season and who, when they entered the fray, were proven unable to win. I'm intrigued to see precisely what the pair learn from one another, given the manners in which their shared bloodline has diverged into different military approaches. Finally, Cersei, whose denial of what is coming her way feels perhaps the most relevant element of the series. Though nothing in the show serves as a direct comment on contemporary politics, her refusal to admit the climate is changing publicly, and then her private admission that it is, but she'll wait for those affected first to deal with the damage, feels all too contemporary. I had expected her not to survive the season precisely because her villainy felt too great to withstand the onslaught of complicated good that Daenerys and Jon presented, but it's become clear that climate-denying evil can get swamped by the climate. Who cares about the villain who wishes winter on you when winter comes? Just as the elements came together to bring a conclusive end to Westeros' summer, with the first flakes dazzling Jaime, so did they come together to wrap up an uneven season. The zombie finale was sufficiently dazzling, and it was preceded by, at very long last, an episode that sets up the stakes and the players' methods in a manner that did more than hypothetical dithering. There have been some great moments in this penultimate season, and a lot of time spent on setup, but the finale's big moments proved that the show's best days still lay ahead.
18 Books to Read Before College, or Long After, by Sarah Begley. Throughout history, college has served not only as preparation for professional life, but also as a period of intense personal growth. It's often the first time away from home and family, and into a wider swath of society. There is exploration, self-doubt, triumph, drama, friendship, and romance. What could serve as better fodder for a novelist? These 18 novels imagine different stories about the college experience, from F. Scott Fitzgerald's Princeton in the 1910s to Rainbow Rowell's University of Nebraska, Lincoln, in the 2010s. Comic or tragic, heavy on satire or social commentary, each of these books offers plenty to reflect on for students preparing to matriculate. The Idiot by Elif Batuman, 2017. As a freshman at Harvard in 1995, Celine falls in love with an older classmate and with the art of email writing. Like many college students, she learns that her fascination with someone else says as much about herself as it does about the object of her desire. 5 Point Someone by Shaitan Bhagat, 2004. A bestseller in India, this novel captures the stresses of life at the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT, in Delhi, where three friends get off to a rocky academic start and struggle to boost their social standing in a setting where GPAs are everything. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Woe by Junot Diaz, 2007. Though the plot of this Pulitzer Prize winner ranges, blending Dominican history with elements of sci-fi and fantasy, some of the most affecting scenes take place while its protagonist, Oscar de Leon, and narrator, Junior de las Casas, are students and roommates at Rutgers University. The Rules of Attraction by Bret Easton Ellis, 1987. Before he wrote American Psycho, Bret Easton Ellis applied his dark sense of humor to a story about love triangles at an elite Northeastern institution, the fictional Camden College, a stand-in for Bennington where Ellis went to school. The students here concern themselves less with academics and more with who to take home after Thirsty Thursday happy hour or the dress-to-get-screwed party. Been Down So Long It Looks Like Up to Me by Richard Farina, 1966. This psychedelic Bildungsroman centers on Gnosis Papadopoulos through his partying and political activity at Mentor University, a stand-in for Cornell, and a trip to a Cuba in revolt. Gnosis brings the spirit of rebellion back to campus. This Side of Paradise by F. Scott Fitzgerald, 1920. Armory Blaine experiences life at Princeton pre-World War I, just as Fitzgerald himself did. Though he starts out as a romantic egoist, Armory's experiences leave him far less confident in romance and in himself than he was when he left his Midwestern hometown. The Gate of Angels by Penelope Fitzgerald. Set at a fictional Cambridge college in 1912, this Man Booker Prize finalist centers on a student, Fred, and a nurse, Daisy, who fall in love after a bicycle accident. As it becomes increasingly apparent that they move in different milieus, Fred faces difficult decisions about the relationship. The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach, 2011. Shortstop Henry Scrimshander is the star of the fictional Westis College Division III baseball team, but his dreams of playing for the major league collapse. Just as he loses his mojo, his web of connections at the college are thrown into various states of drama. Welcome to Bragsville by T. Geronimo Johnson, 2015. In this social satire, four Berkeley students ditch the campus to visit one kid's hometown in Georgia, where citizens annually reenact the Civil War. Equipped with their collegiate political learnings, they decide to stage a protest, but it goes horribly wrong. The Collective by Don Lee, 2012. After his friend Joshua Yoon commits suicide, Eric Cho reflects on their experiences at McAllister College in the late 80s, where they and another friend faced racism on the St. Paul campus. The three eventually go on to form an Asian American artist collective that leads to more racially charged controversy. I'll Take You There by Joyce Carol Oates, 2002. A young woman leaves behind her bleak childhood for 1960s Syracuse, but the narrator of Oates' novel remains a cyber throughout, her personality a blank alongside the women in her sorority house and eventually her first boyfriend. Blue Angel by Francine Prose. Set at the fictional Houston College in Vermont, this novel tackles the controversial subject of student-professor relationships. Prose examines what happens when a has-been novelist falls for his promising young student, satirizing bad writers, bad teachers, and changing campus mores all along the way. Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell, 2013. Freshman year at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln brings many challenges for Kath. Her twin sister Wren won't live without her. She struggles to make new friends on an intimidating campus, and her writing professor is against fan fiction, her favorite activity. Moo by Jane Smiley, 1995. A Midwestern agricultural college, informally known as Moo U, is home to countless schemes, suspicions, and scandals, with the department chair plotting murder, the student body facing off with the bombastic governor, and a student harboring an enormous hog underneath the school building. On Beauty by Zadie Smith, 2005. A family with ties to the Harvard-esque Wellington College feels itself torn apart by personal and academic disagreements. Disgusted by his father's infidelity, one son decamps for England and the warm welcome of his dad's scholarly nemesis. The Secret History by Donna Tartt, 1992. At the fictional Vermont Hampton College, another stand-in for Bennington, Tartt's alma mater where she was friends with Ellis, six classic students from a tight-knit group whose exclusivity and bizarre dynamic grow more mysterious. By graduation day, one of them has been murdered. Bride's Head Revisited by Evelyn Waugh, 1945. Charles Ryder, an undergraduate at Oxford in the 1920s, befriends another student named Lord Sebastian Flight and immediately becomes enchanted by the aristocratic Catholic strata Sebastian and his family inhabit, one quite different from his own. I Am Charlotte Simmons by Tom Wolfe, 2004. When she enrolls at the fictional DuPont University, fresh-faced and prepared for academic success, Charlotte is surprised to see how much her roommates value their social lives over their schoolwork. She finds herself joining in and losing touch with the girl she was when she arrived.
Here's why Harvey victims are being told to file insurance claims by Friday, by Jennifer Kalfas. For thousands of displaced people in Southeast Texas, it's still too early to tell how severely their homes and businesses have been impacted by Hurricane Harvey. Rain continues to pour down on the area, submerging parts of Houston under feet of water. But as residents grapple with the devastating disaster, some lawmakers and lawyers are urging them to file their homeowners' insurance claims quickly, before Friday, that is. That's because a controversial new law, which aims to reduce the number of lawsuits made against insurance companies, is set to go into effect on Friday. House Bill 1774, signed by Texas Governor Greg Abbott on May 27, covers lawsuits that come as a result of weather-related claims, including damage or loss of property due to forces of nature like hurricanes, wind, hail, snow, or rainstorms. It does not apply to flood insurance claims. For those cases covered by the law, it reduces the penalty interest rate from 18% to 10% of the claim, potentially reducing the amount that insurers could be required to pay to policyholders in the event of a lawsuit over a claim. The law also mandates that companies must pay for the plaintiff's attorney fees if homeowners depict the damages done to their homes with at least 80% accuracy, and it requires trial attorneys to warn companies before they are being sued and tell them what they're being sued for. Some lawyers and lawmakers say residents should file a claim by Friday to ensure they'd get the higher penalty rates from insurance companies if they were to file a lawsuit. Attorney Greg Island, a member of the Texas Trial Lawyers Association, says that claims filed by property owners before Friday would still generate 18% interest from the insurance company if the claims were eventually subject to a lawsuit. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat, tweeted that Texans should file for Harvey relief by September 1st. Opponents of the law argue it will allow insurance companies to get away with wrongdoing without being held accountable, and that by reducing the penalty insurers would have to pay for delays, it will make it more difficult for homeowners to get payments on time. There's nothing about this bill that helps policyholders, Will Adams, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Texas Trial Lawyers Association, told the Dallas Morning News. Everything about this bill makes it harder for policyholders to hold insurance companies accountable. But defenders of the law argue it still protects the rights of the homeowner, and it's not clear whether claims over Harvey's damage will actually be affected by the new law. Mark Hanna of the Insurance Council of Texas, which strongly backed the legislation, told Money that claims made before or after Friday would be treated the same way, since the law does not affect the claims process, only the lawsuits that derive from claims. The new law does not change the filing process for a claim from current law, nor does it address how the insurer must handle that claim. Additionally, said Joe Woods, Vice President of State Government Relations for the Property Casualty Insurance Association of America, most of these claims will be flood claims and therefore would not be affected by the law. Of those non-flood claims, he added, an even smaller fraction would eventually end up in a lawsuit. The new law will not apply to most claims or lawsuits arising from Harvey because most of the policyholders' claims will be for damage caused by flooding, Texans for Lawsuit Reform, which supports the new law, said in a statement. These claims will be made under the Federal Flood Insurance Program and governed by federal law. Yet at least some of the damage from Harvey will likely not be covered by flood insurance. Harvey is expected to result in up to $2 billion of insured property loss unrelated to flooding for homes and business properties, according to CoreLogic, a global property information company. CoreLogic reports that more than half of the homes in Houston are not in designated flood zones, meaning owners wouldn't be required to have flood insurance. And those who have home insurance may not have policies that cover flooding, according to the Insurance Council of Texas. The Cassini spacecraft will soon commit suicide on Saturn. Here's what to know, by Mahita Gajanan. After more than a decade of exploring Saturn, the Cassini spacecraft will soon commit suicide by plunging into the planet it's been documenting for years. The spacecraft launched nearly 20 years ago and took about 7 years to make it to Saturn's orbit. Since 2004, Cassini has completed more than 290 orbits of the planet, sending back thousands of stunning images and making discoveries about Saturn, its rings, and its moons. On September 15th, Cassini will die by diving into Saturn's atmosphere. Here's what to know about its mission and final days. What is Cassini's last mission? Before Cassini makes its fatal plunge into Saturn's clouds, the spacecraft will complete what NASA calls a grand finale. The final mission started in April and will end in September as the spacecraft transmits as much data as it can from Saturn before it dies in the clouds. After doing a close flyby of Titan, one of Saturn's moons, Cassini will complete a series of weekly dives between Saturn and its rings, offering a never-before-seen look at one of the solar system's most unique regions. What has it found? Throughout the course of its time documenting Saturn, Cassini has uncovered a trove of new knowledge. Scientists managing the spacecraft have seen through Cassini how the seasons on Saturn change, witnessed a massive storm on the planet, and more. The discovery of methane lakes on the moon Titan and oceans on the moon Enceladus have shown scientists how prevalent and common life beyond Earth may truly be, said Kurt Nieber, a Cassini program scientist, during a NASA press conference on Tuesday. NASA hopes that the last few days of Cassini's life will allow scientists to understand Saturn from the inside out, according to Linda Spilker, a Cassini project scientist. This includes obtaining more information on the composition of Saturn's atmosphere, the interior of the planet, and the age and size of its rings. Cassini's dives between Saturn and its rings has revealed to scientists that there's a complex interaction between the planet's atmosphere and ring particles, and that Saturn's rings are slightly less massive than expected. Why will Cassini die on Saturn? According to NASA, Cassini is running out of rocket fuel, which will eventually prevent mission operators from being able to control where the spacecraft goes. Left to its own devices, the spacecraft could collide with one of Saturn's moons. Because Enceladus was revealed through Cassini's findings to have the potential to carry a habitable environment, NASA wants to avoid a potential situation in which the spacecraft collides with the moon and interferes with a future search for life there. Therefore, NASA has decided to have Cassini die safely on Saturn. These two airlines are giving bonus miles to people who donate to Hurricane Harvey relief. By Brad Tuttle. As the devastation of Hurricane Harvey continues to wreak havoc in Texas, many are wondering how to help the victims. Airlines are now giving people even more reason to be charitable by offering bonus miles if you make donations. To help relief efforts, two major airlines with hubs in Texas are offering bonus miles to those making charitable donations. United Airlines says that Mileage Plus members who go to the airline's fundraising page and give to the American Red Cross, AmeriCares, AirLink, or Operation USA will receive bonus miles at these levels. Donate $50 to $99, earn 250 bonus miles. Donate $100 to $249, earn 500 bonus miles. Donate $250 or more, earn 1,000 bonus miles. American Airlines is also giving bonus miles for Hurricane Harvey relief donations. From now through September 24th, American Airlines Advantage members will earn 10 bonus miles for every $1 donated to the Red Cross. There's a minimum $25 donation. There are ways for travelers to help without making cash donations as well. The Red Cross regularly seeks donations of airline miles, which are used to help transport volunteers and victims, and the organization will happily accept miles from a wide range of airlines, including American, Delta, Southwest, and United. FYI, unlike cash donations, which are tax-deductible, donations of miles or points are considered gifts by the IRS, and they're not tax-deductible. While Hurricane Harvey's impact is being felt across a broad swath of the economy and the costs will continue to pile up for weeks, the effects on the travel industry have been immediate and obvious. According to FlightAware, there were roughly 1,800 flight cancellations in the U.S. on Sunday, plus another 1,700 yesterday and 1,500 today. Houston's two airports have been shut down for days, with 1,400 flights into or out of the city canceled on Monday alone. Cruises have been affected too, with at least four cruise voyages canceled that had itineraries that would have normally docked at Galveston this week. Airbnb is offering to help, too, pairing hurricane evacuees with homeowners willing to take them in. The service is listing spaces that welcome evacuees at no charge, and all normal service fees are being waived as well. Capturing Conflict and Covering Home in Kashmir by Nikhil Kumar. In one photo, anguished relatives try to comfort the wailing sister of a Kashmiri civilian killed during a protest near Srinagar, the main city in the Indian half of disputed Kashmir. In another, a masked protester dodges a tear gas shell fired by Indian forces. A third shows two masked protesters in a village just south of Srinagar. White powder is smeared across their faces. It's salt to protect their eyes from tear gas, says Dar Yassin, the award-winning Associated Press photographer who captured these portraits on the conflict in Kashmir over the summer, and for whom the Himalayan region isn't just an assignment, it's home. Yassin was born and brought up in the Northern Territory that has been a source of tension and the cause of three wars between India and Pakistan ever since 1947, when the colonial British quit the subcontinent. A de facto border called the Line of Control divides the Muslim-majority region between the two nuclear-armed nations, both of which claim Kashmir in its entirety. It's a part of the world where even peacetime can resemble war. Although violence peaked in the 1990s, the bloody consequence, says New Delhi, of a Pakistan-sponsored insurgency, hundreds of thousands of Indian soldiers and paramilitary personnel remained stationed in the Indian section. A special law gives these forces wide-ranging powers to search, detain, and shoot at civilians, an authority that rights groups accuse the Indians of misusing, and one that has bred an atmosphere of suspicion among young Kashmiris. The result is that even outside times of full-blown conflict, the region suffers depressingly regular convulsions of violence, with cycles of protest against the security forces followed by crackdowns and military curfews that bring life to a standstill. For Yassin, who switched from shooting videos to taking photos in 2005, that makes the job of recording and reporting on the Kashmir story a daily task. We cover this conflict day in and day out. It is our daily life, he tells Time. It does not stop. Yassin has been a witness since he was a boy. The first dead body I saw, I must have been in year 5 or 6 at school. There was a protest in Srinagar and 15 guys were shot. And one of the guys who was shot was my neighbor and he was shot right outside our home. It was back in the 1980s, says Yassin, whose elder brother and a cousin are also photojournalists. We are a family of photojournalists. Growing up, we had a dark room at home. Yassin has seen the violence rise and fall and then rise again. Figures from India's Interior Ministry covering the India state of Jammu and Kashmir show that close to 14,000 civilians have lost their lives in the conflict since 1990, along with more than 5,000 security personnel. Last year saw a notable rise in tensions as the region erupted in protests following the killing by Indian security forces of a popular militant commander. According to a written statement by a government minister tabled in India's parliament in July, close to 9,000 civilians were injured and 85 were killed in unrest in the Indian-administered section in 2016. That compares to just over 1,000 injured and 112 civilians killed in 2010. An additional 21 died between January and early July this year. Others estimate a higher death toll for 2016. Citing figures from the Jammu-Kashmir Coalition for Civil Society, a local advocacy group, India's Hindustan Times Daily reported that as many as 145 civilians died in last year's unrest, compared to 172 in 2010. Like other journalists, Yassin has often found himself caught in the crossfire. He recounts an incident from July when he was in a small Kashmiri town covering the funeral of a civilian killed in the violence. I was in the crowd as it was moving with the body when the security forces came and started shelling, he says. Yassin was injured in the ensuing confusion as the crowd began to scatter. I fell down and had to get stitches on my hand, he says. Yassin contrasts covering the conflict in Kashmir, his home, with going on assignment in other conflict zones. We were in Afghanistan recently to cover the war there. It was different. We were there to cover one particular story. We had one thing in mind, he says. We don't know it in the same way, and we had to be more careful. We were always aware that this is foreign soil. Here in Kashmir, we are not telling one story. We are telling our story through the pictures, the whole story, not one part of the story. Sometimes that means convincing his subjects that he's simply doing his job, not pursuing one or the other political agenda. In recent years, as sections of the Indian media have grown more nationalistic, locals have become wary of cooperating with journalists. Last year, for example, when Time went up to Srinagar to cover the violence, visiting a hospital to see the casualties involved first reassuring the relatives of the injured that we did not have any affiliation with the more nationalist Indian outlets. There is this perception on the ground with some people that we're interested in more than just telling the story, says Yassin, who briefly found himself in front of the lens earlier this year when, while covering a Srinagar protest, he rushed in to help an 18-year-old woman who was injured. Seeing Khusbu Jan bleeding from the head, he dropped his camera and carried her to safety, away from the protest in Srinagar. I always try and explain that we don't have an agenda. We are just here to tell the story. FDA cracks down on stem cell clinics, but patients are still at risk. By Alexandra Sifferlin. On Monday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, announced that the agency is targeting clinics that offer unproven stem cell therapies, calling such offices unscrupulous clinics selling so-called cures. The FDA seized materials from one clinic in California and sent a warning letter to another in Florida. The FDA will not allow deceitful actors to take advantage of vulnerable patients by purporting to have treatments or cures for serious diseases without any proof that they actually work, said FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb in a statement. The agency announced that on Friday, August 25th, U.S. Marshals seized 5 vials of a vaccine that's intended for people at a high risk for smallpox, for example, people in the military, from Stem Immune Incorporated in San Diego, California. The FDA says it learned that Stem Immune was using the vaccines as well as stem cells from body fat to create an unapproved stem cell therapy. On its website, Stem Immune says, the patients own autologous adult stem cells armed with potent anti-cancer payloads function like a Trojan horse homing to tumors and cancer cells undetected by the immune system. The stem cell treatment was injected into the tumors of cancer patients at the California Stem Cell Treatment Centers in Rancho Mirage and Beverly Hills, California. The FDA also sent a warning letter to U.S. Stem Cell Clinic in Sunrise, Florida. The company recently came under public scrutiny when a March report revealed that 3 people had severe damage to their vision. One woman went blind after they were given shots of what the company said were stem cells into their eyes during a study sponsored by the clinic. The FDA says that an inspection of U.S. Stem Cell Clinic revealed that the clinic was using stem cells to treat diseases like Parkinson's, ALS, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart disease, and pulmonary fibrosis. According to the FDA, there are currently only a limited number of stem cell therapies approved by the agency, including ones involving bone marrow for bone marrow transplants in cancer care and cord blood for specific blood-related disorders. There are no approved stem cell treatments for other diseases. The FDA says U.S. Stem Cell Clinic also attempted to interfere with the FDA's most recent inspection by refusing to allow FDA inspectors to enter without an appointment and denied the agency access to its employees. Refusing to permit entry or FDA inspection is a violation of federal law, the FDA says. Actions by the FDA on clinics promoting unproven stem cell therapies is a long time coming, says Sean Morrison, former president of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, the ISSCR, and director of the Children's Research Institute at UT Southwestern. Clinics are preying on the hopes of desperate patients claiming they can cure all manner of diseases with stem cells that have not been tested in clinical trials and in some cases are flat out impossible. In the past, medical experts were concerned over Americans traveling to countries with less medical regulation for stem cell therapies, but Morrison says such clinics have been popping up stateside over the last 5 years. It's not a few companies in the U.S. making claims about therapies with stem cells, says Morrison. It's scores of companies. The problem has exploded in the U.S. Morrison blames the lack of FDA crackdown in the past for the growing problem. At some point, people made the calculation that the FDA didn't seem to be enforcing these laws, he says. The margins are huge. They charge people tens of thousands of dollars. Since stem cell therapy is still an active and legitimate area of scientific research, it can be hard for Americans to figure out what's safe and effective and what's not. Even when it comes to clinical trials, the scientific soundness is murky. A July 2017 paper reported that 18 U.S. companies have registered patient-sponsored stem cell studies on clinicaltrials.gov. That means that the patients receiving the treatment paid for them, which isn't the case in more legitimate studies. None of these were gold standard studies, meaning the people were not randomly assigned to receive the treatment or not, so the participants knew they were receiving the therapy. That could bias the results. Only 7 of the studies disclosed upfront that patients had to pay to join the study, and none revealed that the costs ranged from $5,000 to $15,000 a treatment, Wired reports. While Morrison says he's glad the FDA has taken action, he says it's not enough, at least not yet. The FDA has to show that there's really a sustained commitment to enforcement, he says. When the FDA wasn't bringing actions against these companies, I think people thought this meant that it was a gray area and that they could get away with it. Undoing that damage could be a long process and one that Morrison says needs consistent attention by the agency. In a letter released on Monday, FDA Commissioner Gottlieb said the agency is stepping up enforcement of stem cell therapies and regenerative medicine. I've directed the FDA to launch a new working group to pursue unscrupulous clinics through whatever legally enforceable means are necessary to protect the public health, said Gottlieb. Whether those efforts have an impact remains to be seen. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.